Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Drone strikes are currently one of America's favorite warfighting tools. They are tactical, precise. They provide a supposedly clean hit whose public relations aftermath amounts to mostly grainy, sanitized, crosshairs-type imagery that reminds the public of video games, if anything at all. But what will we think of drones 5 or 10 years from now? In a generation, how will we look back upon this now-favored weapon of war? We thought it might be instructive to look back at the story of another once-favored weapon. It was created in Boston, reached its destructive apogee in World War II and Vietnam, and in the public's opinion, mutated from a tool of righteous firepower to a weapon that dare not speak its name. We're speaking, of course, of napalm.
You smell that? Napalm, son! Nothing else in the world smells like that! I love the smell of napalm in the morning. You know, one time we had a hail bomb? For 12 hours when it was all over, I walked up. We didn't find one of them, not one stinking body. The smell! You know, that gasoline smell! The whole hill. It smelled like... victory.
Well, that is, of course, the iconic Lieutenant Colonel Bill Kilgore, played by Robert Duvall in Francis Ford Coppola's epic 1979 film Apocalypse Now. But napalm's true story is even more ironic and intriguing than ever portrayed in pop culture. That story is elegantly told in the new book Napalm, an American Biography by Robert M. Neer. Neer is a lecturer in the history department at Columbia University, and he joins us now in the studio. Robert Neer, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your book is one of the most interesting things I have read in some time, and there's so much to talk about. But why don't we actually begin with some of the basics about what napalm itself is? Now, when it burns hot at, 2100 degrees Fahrenheit? And at that temperature, what does it do to the materials that it touches?
Well, it burns very with extreme heat, anything that it touches. I mean, fire transmits its energy most directly to whatever it touches. So the tip of a match is actually the most hot exactly where it's burning, and then above it and to the sides and below it. So since napalm is sticky, it transmits heat directly into whatever it's touching very effectively. It will burn skin right down to the bone. It will burn wood or anything that it comes in contact with.
And at 2100 degrees, we looked this up, that makes it one-fifth as hot as the surface of the sun. So it's a hot-burning chemical. But what makes it such a great military weapon?
Well, the real genius of the people at Harvard who invented it was to devise a chemical concoction that could be added to any kind of petroleum. And actually, napalm just means thickened petroleum of any kind. And they devised this mixture that was inexpensive, that could be stored at very cold temperatures. For example, in a bomber very high in the sky over Japan, it gets very cold, especially in the wintertime. Or in very hot temperatures, for example, in the tropics, in a storage facility, it could get very hot. It could be mixed, travel in powdered form and then be mixed with gasoline. So it's really a remarkable invention. It also had some extraordinary properties. For example, when it's under pressure, napalm liquefies, so it could be used to shoot in a flamethrower much farther than previous mixtures of rubber and gasoline. As early as World War I and even before that, there were incendiary weapons fashioned from rubber. But it wasn't until this chemical material was invented in World War II in a top-secret research program at Harvard University that gelled incendiary weapons really came into their modern form.
So it's stable, it's flexible in terms of its use and properties, and of course we talked about how effective it is in actually destroying things. So you can see why it became such a favored weapon of the military in World War II and then through Korea and obviously Vietnam as well. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But you mentioned the thing that was one of the first of many eye-openers for me, and that was that napalm was developed at Harvard University in the 1940s. At that time, under the relatively benign name of Anonymous Research Project Number 4, run by a man named Louis Fieser. So tell us a little bit about him.
Louis Fieser was really a remarkable chemist. He devoted his whole life to finding chemical substances that could aid in human health. He devoted his genius to isolating vitamin K, which is an important chemical. Later on, he was a member of the 1964 Surgeon General's panel that determined that cigarette smoking was dangerous to health. He educated many thousands of students at Harvard College in chemistry. Many of them went on to be doctors because, you know, organic chemistry is a rite of passage for pre-medical students. And he also used his genius to produce a remarkable incendiary weapon at 11 Oxford Street in the Converse Chemistry Laboratory, which is still there, right close to Memorial Hall. He announced the discovery to the government supervisors of this top-secret collaboration between Harvard and the U.S. government on Valentine's Day, 1942.
And it's interesting because all this is going on, it's a new era of collaboration between the government and academic institutions, which I'll ask you about in a moment. But it's all going on while memories of, for example, the use of poison gas in World War I is still very fresh in people's minds. I mean, another proponent of new weapons development was the then Harvard president, James Bryant Conant, who you quote in the book in the 40s as saying, quote, "It's unclear why tearing a man's guts out by high explosive shells is to be preferred to maiming him by attacking his lungs or skin." So he had some moral clarity on the use of new weapons. Did Fieser share that same clarity?
Yeah, Conant, for his part, had worked on poison gas programs during World War I. And you articulate very well his views on those. Fieser himself was actually initially assigned by government research officials to work on poison gas because prior to World War II and in the early stages of World War II, the government mobilized the nation's academics and especially its chemists to work on all kinds of different aspects of war fighting. Fieser himself didn't really want to work on poison gas very much, and he converted his budget to work on incendiary weapons through some really fascinating bits of bureaucratic infighting. He said that he considered poison gas to be distasteful. It was also against international covenants at the time. And most of all, he thought it wasn't likely to be used. So he wanted to work on a weapon that he thought would be more likely to be useful.
Useful. Well, we find out later just how useful it is. But before we get to Fieser's actual breakthrough and those first tests at Harvard, I did want to ask you one quick thing about sort of the larger bureaucracy and how the development of napalm was really emblematic of how the relationship between the federal government and academia changes. Because this was one of the first times, according to your new book, Napalm, An American Biography, where the government really put a lot of money directly into academia to develop new weapons rather than to its own government labs. And subsequently, I mean, that sort of relationship of the government using universities to create, you know, new technologies of all kinds is basically de facto how we do things today. And this all came about in the era of napalm development.
Yeah, an interesting aspect of this weapons development is that it speaks to many other issues that are part of our society today and really even of worldwide significance. Exactly as you say, prior to World War II, most government research work on munitions and weapons was done in military laboratories. I mean, some of it still is, but the government decided, Franklin D. Roosevelt, a gentleman named Vannevar Bush, who was really the person who came up with this idea,
founder of Raytheon,
among other achievements. decided that they could develop or harness America's technical infrastructure much more effectively and quickly by providing money to universities, which already had an enormous infrastructure, both physical and personal, and also allowed them to sidestep civil service rules that limited some of the things that they could do and provide money directly to universities, often on a cost-plus basis, and use the scientists that were there, who were happy to be used in this way, to do research projects that could be used with military applications. And that's how napalm and other weapons were invented.
Well, there's so much more to talk about. Listeners, I'm speaking with Robert M. Neer. His new book is Napalm, An American Biography. And Bob Neer, I wonder if you could just tell us the story briefly, because I want to talk about how it was actually used during in various wars throughout the 20th century. But I was wondering if you could just tell us the story briefly of the first test that happened of napalm in a soccer field at Harvard University that proved that this could actually be a feasible weapon of war.
Sure. Did you want me to read a brief passage from
the
book?
Sure, go ahead. Actually, it's very well written, so why don't you?
Thank you. As I mentioned, napalm was originally invented on Oxford Street in Cambridge in the lab. But then, of course, they had to test it. And it was tested in a shallow pool that was dug into the Harvard College soccer field, which is right behind the Harvard Business School and across the street from the Harvard Stadium, and is still used as a soccer field, on July 4th, 1942. The two paragraphs that you wanted me to read say, Fieser arrived. He was 43 years old, tall, bald, with traces of the Williams College varsity football lineman that he once was, still present in his bearing. An octet of assistants followed. He equipped four of the young men with boots, buckets, long sticks, and gloves, and positioned them around the pool. With assistance from the others, he gingerly lugged a live 70-pound napalm bomb, bolted nose down on a metal stand, to the center of the lagoon. A wire ran to a control box on dry ground. Firemen and groundskeepers looked on, and tennis players 50 feet away traded forehands. Fieser flipped a switch. High explosives blasted incendiary white phosphorus into 45 pounds of jellied gasoline. A spectacular, billowing 2,100-degree Fahrenheit fire cloud rose over the field. Lumps of searing, flaming napalm splashed into the water. Oily smoke filled the air. Assistants plunged into the muck, splashed water on burning blobs, and used their sticks to submerge and extinguish larger gobbets. They noted the location and size of chunks and scooped salvageable jelly into buckets for weighing. Tennis players scattered.
That's Robert M. Neer reading from his new book, Napalm, An American Biography, just recounting the scene of the first testing of napalm at Harvard University at a soccer field while tennis players scattered. One can only imagine what they were thinking was going on, but we know what happened to the use of napalm itself in the subsequent years and decades, and of course it was used. It was actually used in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And let me ask you, at that time when they were doing that initial testing after the Harvard soccer field, you write that the army and the military, for example, they took over a town in Indiana and tested napalm on residential structures there, and that they even went so far as to send a scientist or a researcher thousands of miles to collect tatami mats that were used in Japanese homes and tested the effects of napalm on that. And you include a fascinating table of results of what napalm does to Japanese homes and German homes in terms of the effects that the fire has. All this makes me think that in advance they knew that this is a weapon that would likely be used against civilians.
Or residences, anyway.
Or residents.
Yeah. The army was extraordinarily devoted to providing a really accurate testing facility for this new weapon that it had invented. And it wasn't entirely clear from the outset that napalm, the formulation that was developed by the scientists at Harvard, is what would be selected as the incendiary weapon that the United States would use in World War II. They had a competition. Other companies like DuPont and even Eastman Kodak had entered their own gel formulations. In Indiana, as you mentioned, the Army condemned two villages so that they could use the homes and buildings in those villages for tests of these different kinds of incendiary gels that they had developed. And then after the British, in particular, expressed some skepticism about whether those tests had been effective enough or whether the architecture of the buildings was similar enough to what might be encountered in Germany and Japan, They actually built two entire villages, replica villages, one German and one Japanese in Utah at a new testing facility there, and really spared no effort or expense to make them accurate. As you mentioned, collected tatami, traveled thousands of miles to collect tatami from Japanese homes and even temples in Hawaii and on the West Coast, intercepted a shipment of special wood that was similar to that used in Japan. RKO Studios was enlisted to help with set design. Reopened a shuttered furniture factory in upstate New York that made German-style furniture so that they could furnish these dwellings. And in the book, you can see pictures of the model houses and the even bedrooms that they had designed.
And yet, Fieser, through all this, I mean, you quote him from a 1970 memoir, I believe, that he wrote, where he said, "Our testing and our thinking were in terms of the burning of structures, not personnel."
Yeah, absolutely. Fieser, I mean, later on, as you know, and we can discuss, napalm became extremely controversial. It really wasn't controversial during the Second World War or the Korean War, and it was used in lots of places besides that, because after World War II, many countries saw its attractions and effectiveness and put it to work. But Fieser himself said that his thinking, as he put it later, was always that napalm would be used against things, not against babies or Buddhists. That was his term. I think that it's a difficult issue. I mean, Kim Fook, the little girl who was pictured in that 1972 photograph running down the road, I asked her what she thought about napalm itself. She said that it's like a knife. It's not an evil thing in itself. It depends how it's used. So really, that puts the onus on how it would be used. It's hard to imagine that Fieser wouldn't have had some idea about how it could be used since they were testing it against homes.
Well, let's talk about one specific event and how it was used in World War II, because it really came into, I mean, it was developed during the Second World War, and as soon as it was approved as a feasible and viable weapon, it was put into use, most devastatingly in Japan. And so let's talk about exactly what the United States did to Tokyo on the night of March 9th, 1945.
So throughout most of World War II, the United States' bombing strategy was called precision bombing. It wasn't always so precise because often there were clouds in the way, or people got lost, or radar wasn't very accurate. But the ambition was to attack military targets. And that's what the strategy was initially against Japan as well. But after weeks and weeks of unsuccessful bombing against those specifically military targets, the United States replaced the commander of its bombing operations in the Pacific with a general named Curtis LeMay. And LeMay adopted a new strategy. Instead of attacking during the daytime, he would attack at night. Instead of attacking in formation, he would attack by just sending bombers over, not in any particular formation. Instead of flying high, he would fly low. And they even removed defensive armaments from the bombers, which was a tremendously controversial and risky step, so that they could pack more napalm into them.
And how did this all come to a head in Tokyo?
On March 9th, in the middle of a hurricane, hundreds of U.S. bombers dropped several hundred thousand small napalm bombs on the city of Tokyo and started one of the world's first and most deadly to this date firestorms. 7,500 or more people died in one night, more than were killed at either Hiroshima or Nagasaki. So basically, the United States did with napalm what it later did with atomic weapons to the city of Tokyo.
Well, if I may, I mean, and you write so shockingly clearly about what happened in Tokyo. The damage was apocalyptic, in your very well-chosen term. I mean, the firestorm that it created a column of smoke, what, 18,000 feet high? And pilots later reported that even at altitudes of 5,000 feet, they could smell the burning flesh of those 87,000 dying Japanese. I mean, Robert McNamara, you quote, later, much, much later, in 2003, says, even though he was part and parcel of this at the time, said what the United States did to Tokyo bordered on a war crime.
That's what Mark McNamara said. I mean, I think that from a historical perspective, one of the most remarkable things is that night for America, for this country, introduced a kind of warfare that really is the basis for our current lives, or people might even say the modern age, in which we contemplate, you know, you and me, our city of Boston, New York, London, Los Angeles, Moscow, Beijing, Japan, they all live under this sword of Damocles of devastation of an entire city. And that night was the first night that the U.S. Wrought that kind of devastation on another city. It's worth noting that that kind of incendiary bombardment of cities in World War II was first practiced by Germany, the city of Guernica, it was a smaller place, but was attacked in a similar way with firebombs. The Japanese attacked Shanghai that way.
And the Brits attacked Dresden.
And the British burned up Dresden and also Hamburg and other places.
You know, it breaks my heart to say that we are running out of time, but we are, because there's just so much that's interesting to talk about this, because obviously the United States continues to use napalm through Korea in Vietnam, but it's in Vietnam where public opinion turns wildly against this weapon. And in the last couple minutes that we have here, I wonder if you could tell us, what does that turning of public opinion against napalm tell us about America's perception of the weapon and of how we were fighting a war?
In the 1960s, a small group of protesters, first in California and later the youth of America, you could say, at college campuses across the country, made napalm a pariah weapon. It was a symbol of the Vietnam War. And after America's defeat in the Vietnam War, 1972 was that picture you mentioned of that little girl, mm-hmm. and later on, napalm really, you could say, almost became a scapegoat for that war, or a symbol at least of the defeat. And popular culture subsequently turned it into a pariah. You had that clip from Apocalypse Now. I mean, the napalm in that clip just left the smell of victory, not victory.
But the United States used napalm or incendiary jellied gases or gasoline in Iraq in the early 2000s.
Yeah, the Pentagon, I mean, it's legal to use napalm on the battlefield under current international law, although it is against the law, it's a war crime, to use it against a concentration of civilians, according to Protocol 3 of a 1980 United Nations treaty, which the United States, after waiting for about three decades, finally signed. President Barack Obama signed it on his first full day of office, with a reservation, which basically says that the United States can ignore that treaty if, in its sole discretion, using incendiary weapons would save civilian lives compared to not using them.
How does the world perceive that caveat?
Maybe not so well, I think. It is certainly a position that sets the United States at variance exceptionally compared to the rest of the world, many, many countries of which have signed that treaty without that caveat. But this is America's weapon, and it has been used more by the United States in more places for a longer period of time than anybody else. In the case of Iraq, because napalm just means any kind of thickened petroleum, the United States used what it calls firebombs, which are really filled with napalm, against several troop positions to devastating effect during the Iraq War.
Well, listeners, there's so much more to learn about the history of napalm through Robert Neer's new book. We have a link to his website at radioboston.org. And Robert Neer is a lecturer in American history at Columbia University and author of the new book, the first of its kind, I should say, Napalm, An American Biography. It's published this week, actually. And Mr. Neer, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm a fan of your show. It's an honor to be here, and thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have guests like you to tell us about the history that's taking place in our own backyard without us maybe even knowing it. Well, listeners, stick with us because there is more of the show ahead. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.